chapter 5. The people, the empire, providential preparations, impulse of the Reformation, peace, middle classes, national character, yoke of the Pope, state of the empire, opposition to Rome, the burghers, Switzerland, valor, liberty, small cantons, Italy, obstacles to reform, Spain, obstacles, Portugal, France, preparations, hopes deceived, the Netherlands, England, Scotland, the North, Russia, Poland, Bohemia, Hungary. The discoveries made by kings had gradually extended to their subjects. The wise began to habituate themselves to the idea that the Bishop of Rome was only a man, and sometimes even a very bad man. They had a suspicion that he was no holier than the bishops, whose reputation was very equivocal. The licentiousness of the popes roused the indignation of Christendom, and hatred of the Roman name rankled in the heart of the nations. Numerous causes concurred in facilitating the deliverance of the different countries of the West. Well, let us glance at these countries. The empire was a confederation of different states, with an emperor at their head, each state having supreme authority within its own territory. The imperial diet, composed of all the princes or sovereign states, legislated for the whole Germanic body. It belonged to the emperor to ratify the laws, decrees, or resolutions of the assembly, and to see them applied and carried into execution, while the seven most powerful princes, under the title of electors, had the disposal of the imperial crown. The north of Germany, inhabited chiefly by the ancient Saxon race, had acquired the greatest degree of freedom. The emperor, incessantly attacked by the Turks and his hereditary possessions, was obliged to court those princes and bold nations whose aid was then necessary to him. Free towns in the north, west, and south of the empire had, by their trade, their manufactures, and exertions of every description, risen to a high degree of prosperity, and thereby of independence, but with the powerful House of Austria, then invested with the imperial crown, held the greater part of the southern states of Germany under its control, and closely watched their movements. It was preparing to extend its dominion over the whole empire, and even beyond it, when the Reformation interposed a mighty barrier to its encroachments, and saved the independence of Europe. As Judea, when Christianity arose, was in the center of the ancient world, so Germany was in the center of Christendom, looking at once toward the Netherlands, England, France, Switzerland, Italy, Hungary, Bohemia, Poland, Denmark, and all the North. It was in the heart of Europe that the principle of life was to be developed, and the beatings of this heart were to circulate through all the arteries of the body, the noble blood, which was to give animation to all its members. The particular constitution which the empire had received conformably to the dispensation of Providence favored the propagation of new ideas. Had Germany been a monarchy properly, so-called, like France or England, well, the arbitrary will of the monarch might have been able long to arrest the progress of the gospel. But it was a confederation. Truth attacked in one state might be received with favor in another. The internal peace, which Maximilian had just secured for the empire, was not less favorable to the Reformation. For a long time, the numerous members of the Germanic body had taken pleasure in tearing each other apart. Nothing had been seen but trouble and discord, war incessantly renewed, neighbor against neighbor, town against town, and noble against noble. Maximilian had given a solid basis to public order by erecting the imperial chamber, with power to decide in all questions between different states. The inhabitants of Germany, after all their troubles and disquietudes, saw the commencement of a new era of security and repose. Well, nevertheless, when Luther appeared, Germany still presented to the observing eye that kind of motion which agitates the sea after long protracted storms. The calm was uncertain. More than one example of this will be seen as we proceed. By giving an entirely new impulse to the Germanic nations, the Reformation put an end forever to all the former causes of agitation, destroying the system of barbarism which had till then been paramount. It put Europe in possession of a new system. Christianity had, at the same time, exercised a peculiar influence on Germany. The middle classes had made rapid improvement. Throughout the different quarters of the empire, and more especially in the free towns, were numerous institutions well fitted to improve the great mass of the population. In these, arts flourished. The burghers, by the way, that's spelled B-U-R-G-H-E-R-S, the burghers, devoting themselves in security to the calm toils and sweet relations of social life, became more and more accessible to knowledge, and in this way were continually acquiring new influence and authority. The foundation of the Reformation in Germany was not to be laid by magistrates, who must often shape their conduct according to political exigencies, nor by nobles fired with the love of military glory, nor by a greedy and ambitious clergy working religion for profit, as it were their exclusive property. All the task was reserved for the citizens, the commonality, the great body of the people. The national character of the Germans was specially fitted to adapt itself to a religious reformation. No spurious civilization had innervated it. The precious seed, which the fear of God deposits in the bosom of a people, had not been thrown to the winds. Ancient manners yet existed, displaying themselves in that integrity and fidelity, that love of labor, that perseverance, that serious temper, which is still to be seen, and gives presage of greater success to the gospel than the jeering levity or boorish temper of some other European nations. The people of Germany were indebted to Rome for the great instrument of modern civilization, that is, faith, polish, learning, laws, all save their courage and their arms, had come from the sacerdotal city. And, in consequence, Germany had always after been in close alliance with the papacy. The one was a kind of spiritual conquest by the other. And we all know to what purposes Rome has invariably applied her conquests. Nations which were in possession of faith and civilization before a Roman pontiff existed always maintained, in regard to him, a great measure of independence. Still the more thorough the subjugation of the German, the more powerful will the reaction be when the period of awakening shall arrive? When Germany does open her eyes, she will indignantly break loose from the chains which have so long held her captive. The bondage she has had to endure will make her more sensible of her need of deliverance and freedom, and bold champions of the truth will come forth from this house of hard labor and bondage in which all her people have for ages been confined. And there was, at that time in Germany, what the politicians of our days call a seesaw system. When the emperor was of a resolute character, his power increased. When, on the contrary, he was of a feeble character, the influence and power of the princes and electors were enlarged. Never had these felt themselves stronger in regard to their chief than in the time of Maximilian, at the period of the Reformation. And as he took part against it, it is easy to understand how favorable the circumstance of his comparative weakness must have been to the propagation of the gospel. And moreover, Germany was tired of what the Romans derisively styled the patience of the Germans. Well, they had indeed shown much patience from the days of Louis of Bavaria, when the emperors laid down their arms and the tiara was placed, without opposition, above the crown of the Caesars. The contest, however, had done little more than change its place by descending several steps. The same struggles which the emperors and popes had exhibited to the world were soon renewed on a smaller scale in all the towns of Germany between the bishops and the magistrates. The burghers took up the sword which the emperors had allowed to drop from their hands. As early as 1329, the burghers of Frankfurt on the Oder had intrepidly withstood all their ecclesiastical superiors. Excommunicated for having continued faithful to the Margrave Louis, they had been left for 28 years without Mass, baptism, marriage, or Christian burial. And when the monks and priests made their re-entry, they laughed at it like it was a comedy or a farce. Sad symptoms, doubtless, but symptoms of which the clergy were the cause. At the period of the Reformation, this opposition between the magistrates and the ecclesiastics had increased. The privileges of the former and the temporal pretensions of the latter were constantly causing jostling and collision between the two bodies. But burgomasters, counselors, and secretaries of towns were not the only persons among whom Rome and the clergy found opponents. Wrath was at the same time fermenting among the people and broke out as early as 1502, when the peasantry, indignant at the grinding yoke of their ecclesiastical sovereigns, entered into a combination which goes under the name of the Shoe Alliance. Thus everywhere, both in the upper and lower regions of society, a grumbling sound was heard, a precursor of the thunder which was soon to burst. Germany seemed ripe for the work which the 16th century had received as its task. Providence, which moves leisurely, had everything prepared, and the very passions which God condemns were to be overruled by his mighty hand for the accomplishment of his designs. Now let us see how other nations were situated. 13 small republics, placed with their confederates in the center of Europe among mountains, forming, as it were, its citadel, contained a brave and simple people. Who would have gone to those obscure valleys in quest of persons who, with the sons of Germany, might be the deliverers of the church? Who would have thought that petty, unknown towns, just emerging from barbarism, hid behind inaccessible mountains at the extremity of nameless lakes would, in point of Christianity, take precedence of Jerusalem, Antioch, Ephesus, Corinth, and Rome. Well, nevertheless, it so pleased him who wills that one spot of earth be watered with dew, and that another spot on which the rain has not descended shall remain parched. You find that in Amos. There were other circumstances besides, which might have been expected to throw numerous obstacles in the way of the Reformation among the Helvetic republics. If, in a monarchy, the impediments of power were to be dreaded, the thing to be feared in a democracy was the precipitation of the people. But Switzerland had also had its preparations. It was a wild but noble tree, which had been preserved in the bosom of the valleys, in order that a valuable fruit might one day be engrafted on it. Providence had diffused among this new people principles of independence and freedom, destined to display their full power whenever the signal for contest with Rome should be given. The Pope had given the Swiss the title of protectors of the liberty of the church, but they seem to have taken the honorable appellation in a very different sense from the pontiff. If their soldiers guarded the Pope in the vicinity of the ancient capital, their citizens in the bosom of the Alps, who carefully guarded their religious liberties against the assaults of the Pope and the clergy. Ecclesiastics were forbidden to apply to a foreign jurisdiction. The letter of the priests, that's Pfaffenbrief in 1370, the letters of the priests was an energetic protestation of Swiss liberty against the abuses and power of the clergy. Among these states, Zurich was distinguished for its courageous opposition to the pretensions of Rome. Geneva, at the other extremity of Switzerland, was at war with its bishop. And these two towns particularly signalized themselves in the great struggle which we have undertaken to describe. But if these Swiss towns, accessible to every kind of improvement, were among the first to fall in with the movement of reform, well, it was otherwise with the inhabitants of the mountains. The light had not yet traveled so far. These cantons, the founders of Swiss freedom, proud of the part which they had performed in the great struggle for independence, were not readily disposed to imitate their younger brethren of the plains. Why change that faith with which they had chased Austria, and which had by its altars consecrated all the scenes of their triumph? Well, their priests were the only enlightened guides to whom they could have recourse. Their worship and their festivals gave a turn to the monotony of their tranquil life, and pleasantly broke the silence of their peaceful retreats. They remained impervious to religious innovation. On crossing the Alps, we find ourselves in that Italy, which was, in the eyes of the majority, the holy land of Christendom. Whence should Europe have expected the good of the church, if not from Italy, and if not from Rome? Might not the power by which turns raised so many different characters to the pontifical chair one day place in it a pontiff who would become an instrument of blessing to the heritage of the Lord? Or if pontiffs were to be despaired of, well, were there not bishops and councils who might reform the church? Nothing good comes out of Nazareth, but out of Jerusalem, out of Rome. Well, such might be the thoughts of men, but God thought otherwise. And he said, quote, "Let him who is filthy be filthy still," close quote. It's Revelation chapter 22. and abandon Italy to her iniquities. This land of ancient glory was alternately a prey to intestine wars and foreign invasion. The wiles of politics, the violence of faction, the turmoil of war seemed to have sole sway and to banish far away both the gospel and its peace. Besides, Italy, broken, dismembered, and without unity, seemed little fitted to receive a common impulse. And each frontier was a new barrier where truth was arrested. And if the truth was to come from the north, how could the Italians, with a taste so refined and a society in their eyes so exquisite, condescend to receive anything at the hands of barbarous Germans? Were men who admired the cadence of a sonnet more than the majesty and simplicity of the scriptures a propitious soil for the seed of the divine word? But be this as it may, in regard to Italy, Rome was still to continue as Rome. Not only did the temporal power of the popes dispose the different Italian factions to purchase their alliance and favor at any price, but in addition to this, the universal ascendancy of Rome presented various attractions to the avarice and vanity of the ultramontane states. The moment that the question of emancipating the rest of the world from Rome should be raised, Italy would again become Italy. Domestic quarrels would not prevail to the advantage of a foreign system. Attacks on the head of the peninsular family would at once revive affections and common interests which had long been in abeyance. The Reformation had therefore little chance in that quarter. And yet there did exist, beyond the mountains, individuals who had been prepared to receive the gospel light. And Italy was not entirely disinherited. Spain had what Italy had not, a grave, noble, and religiously disposed people. At all times has it numbered men of piety and learning among its clergy, while it was distant enough from Rome to be able easily to shake off the yoke. There are few nations where one might have more reasonably hoped for a revival of that primitive Christianity which Spain perhaps received from the Apostle Paul himself. And yet, Spain did not raise her head among the nations. She was destined to fulfill the declaration of divine wisdom, quote, "The first shall be last," close quote. Various circumstances led to this sad result. Spain, in consequence of its isolated position and its distance from Germany, must have felt only slight shocks of the great earthquake which so violently heaved the empire. It was, moreover, engrossed with treasures very different from those which the Word of God then offered to the nations. The new world eclipsed the eternal world. A land altogether new, and apparently silver and gold, inflamed all imaginations. An ardent desire for riches left no room in the Spanish heart for nobler thoughts. A powerful clergy with scaffolds and treasures at its disposal ruled the peninsula. The Spaniard willingly yielded a servile obedience to his priests, who, disburdening him of the prior claims of spiritual occupation, left him free to follow his passions, and to run the way of riches, discoveries, and new continents. Victorious over the Moors are Muslims, Spain had, at the expense of her noblest blood, pulled down the crescent from the walls of Granada and many other cities, and in its place planted the cross of Jesus Christ. This great zeal for Christianity, which seemed to give bright hopes, turned against the truth. Why should Catholic Spain, which had vanquished infidelity, not oppose heresy? How should those who had chased Muhammad from their lovely country allow Luther to penetrate into it? Their kings did even more. They fitted out fleets against the Reformation, and in their eagerness to vanquish it, went to seek it in Holland and England. But these attacks aggrandized the nations against which they were directed, and their power soon crushed Spain. In this way, these Catholic regions lost through the Reformation. Even that temporal prosperity, which was the primary cause of their rejection of the spiritual liberty of the gospel. Nevertheless, it was a brave and generous people that dwelt beyond the Pyrenees. Several of their noble sons, with the same ardor, but with more light than those who had shed their blood in Moorish dungeons, came to lay their life as an offering on the faggot piles of the Inquisition. By the way, for those of you who don't know, a faggot is a bundle of sticks. It was nearly the same with Portugal as with Spain. Emmanuel the Happy gave it an age of gold, which must have unfitted it for the self-denial which the gospel demands. The Portuguese, rushing into the recently discovered routes to the East Indies and Brazil, turned their backs on Europe and the Reformation. Few nations might have been thought more disposed than France to receive the gospel. Almost all the intellectual and spiritual life of the Middle Ages centered in her. One would have said that the paths were already beaten for a great manifestation of the truth. Men who were the most opposed to each other and who had the greatest influence on the French people felt that they had some affinity with the Reformation. Saint Bernard had given an example of that heartfelt faith, that inward piety, which is the finest feature of the Reformation, while Abelard had introduced into the study of theology that reasoning principle, which, incapable of establishing truth, is powerful in destroying falsehood. Numerous heretics, so-called, had rekindled the flames of the Word of God in the French provinces. The University of Paris had withstood the church to the face and not feared to combat her. At the beginning of the 15th century, the Clemangi and the Gersons had spoken out boldly. The pragmatic sanction had been a great act of independence and promised to prove the palladium of the Galatian liberties. The French nobility, so numerous and so jealous of the precedents, and who at this period had just seen their privileges gradually suppressed to the extension of the influence of the crown, must have felt favorably disposed towards a religious revolution. Well, the effect of which might be to restore a portion of the independence which they had lost. The people, lively, intelligent, and open to generous emotions, were accessible to the truth in a degree as great, if not greater, than any other people. The Reformation might have promised to be, in this nation, the birth that was to crown the long travail of many ages. But the Church of France, which seemed for so many generations to have been rushing in the same direction, turned suddenly round at the moment of the Reformation and took quite a contrary direction. And such was the will of him who guides the nations and their rulers. The prince who then sat in the chariot and held the reins, and who, as a lover of letters, might have been thought likely to be the first to second reform, threw his people into another course. The symptoms of several centuries proved fallacious, and the impulse given to France struck and spent itself on the ambition and fanaticism of its kings. The Valois took the place which she ought to have occupied. Well, perhaps if she had received the gospel, she would have become too powerful. And God was pleased to take the feeblest nations, nations that as yet were not, to make them the depositaries of his truth. France, after having been almost reformed, ultimately found herself again become Roman Catholic. The sword of princes thrown into the scale made it incline towards Rome. Alas, another sword, that of the Reformed themselves, completed the ruin of the Reformation. Hands habituated to the sword, unlearned to pray. That's pray. It is by the blood of its confessors, and not by that of its enemies, that the gospel triumphs. At this time, the Netherlands was one of the most flourishing countries in Europe. It contained an industrious population, enlightened by the numerous relations which it maintained with the different quarters of the world, full of courage and zealous to excess for its independence, its privileges, and its freedom. Placed on the threshold of Germany, it must have been one of the first to hear the sound of the Reformation. Two parties, quite distinct from each other, occupied these provinces. The more southern one was surfeited with wealth and submitted. How could all those manufactures carried to the highest perfection? How could that boundless traffic by land and sea? How could Brugge, the great entrepot of the trade of the north? How could Antwerp, that queen of commercial cities, accommodate themselves to a long and sanguinary struggle for points of faith? Well, on the contrary, the northern provinces, defended by their sands, the sea, and their inland waters, and still more by the simplicity of their manners, and their determination to lose all sooner than the gospel, not only saved their franchises, their privileges, and their faith, but also conquered their independence and glorious national character. England scarcely seemed to promise what she has since performed. Repulsed from the continent, where she had so long been obstinately bent on conquering France, she began to throw her eye toward the ocean as the domain which was to be the true scene of her conquests and which was reserved for her inheritance. Twice converted to Christianity, once under the ancient Britons and the second time under the Anglo-Saxons, she very devoutly paid to Rome the annual tribute of St. Peter. But she was reserved for higher destinies. Mistress of the ocean and present at once in all the different quarters of the globe, she, with the nations that were to spring from her, was one day to be the hand of God in shedding the seeds of life over the remotest islands and the largest continents. Already, several circumstances gave a presentiment of her destiny. Bright lights had shone in the British Isles, and some glimmerings still remained. A multitude of foreigners, artists, merchants, and mechanics, arriving from the Netherlands, Germany, and other countries, filled their cities and their seaports. The new religious ideas must have been conveyed easily and rapidly. In fine, the reigning monarch was an eccentric prince who, possessed of some knowledge and great courage, was every moment changing his projects and ideas and turning from side to side according to the direction in which his violent passions blew. It was possible that one of the inconsistencies of Henry VIII might prove favorable to the Reformation. Scotland was at this time agitated by factions. A king 5 years old, a queen regent, ambitious nobles, and an influential clergy kept this bold nation in constant turmoil. It was, nevertheless, one day to hold a first place among those that received the Reformation. The three kingdoms of the North, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, were united under a common scepter. These rude and warlike nations seemed to have little in common with the doctrine of love and peace, and yet, by their very energy, they were, perhaps, more disposed than the people of the South to receive the evangelical doctrine and its power. But the descendants of warriors and pirates, they brought, it would seem, too warlike a character to the Protestant cause. At a later period, their sword defended it with heroism. Russia retired Russia, retired at the extremity of Europe, had few relations with other states, and belonged, moreover, to the Greek communion. The Reformation effected in the Western exerted little or no influence on the Eastern Church. Poland seemed well prepared for a reform. The vicinity of the Christians of Bohemia and Moravia had disposed it to receive, while the vicinity of Germany must have rapidly communicated the evangelical impulse. So early as the year 1500, the nobility of Poland proper had demanded the cup for the laity, appealing to the usage of the primitive church. The liberty enjoyed by its towns and the independence of its nobles made it a safe asylum for Christians persecuted in their own country. And the truth which they brought thither was received with joy by a great number of its inhabitants. In our days, however, it is one of the countries which has the smallest number of confessors. The flame of Reformation, which had long gleamed in Bohemia, had been almost extinguished in blood. Nevertheless, precious remains which had escaped the carnage still survived to see the day of which Jan Hus had a presentiment. Hungary had been torn by intestine wars under the government of princes without character and without experience, who had at last yoked the fate of their people to Austria by giving this powerful house a place among the heirs of the crown. And such was the state of Europe at the beginning of the 16th century, which was destined to produce so mighty a transformation in Christian society.